Well, good afternoon, Juno. Pat Moore, your host today for Juno Afternoon. I have a wonderful lineup of guests for you this afternoon. Kenny Campbell will be here from UAS. She's going to talk to us about year-end giving. Bruce Simonson about this weekend's performances by the Juno Box Society. Phoebe Rohrbacher will drop by to highlight Saturday's World AIDS Day. And a new game has been invented and is being marketed in Juno. It's called Historical Conquest. Zach Edwards will be here to tell us about that. And we're going to have the on-the-air release of Alaskan Imperial Red Beer today. So stay tuned for that. Weather forecast looks like high winds. As a matter of fact, it's so big that it's a high wind warning. It's in effect until 6 p.m. this evening for downtown Juneau and Douglas. And we're talking about gusts to 60 miles per hour. Those will probably run all the way through Saturday and maybe into Sunday. So we'll be back with guests in a moment. Here is National Native News.
Native Voice 1. The Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Controversy surrounds the destruction of a 2,000-year-old bison kill site on the Crow Reservation in Montana for coal mine expansion. Sarah Hosseini reports.
No one claims that federal protocol wasn't followed prior to Westmoreland Resources' purchase of the coal lease on the Crow Reservation, which included a football field's worth of ancient bison bones and artifacts. Businesses routinely discover archaeological sites, and the federal process for dealing with such sites is tightly regulated. The difference in this case was that the land in question is tribal land. And now, there are claims that just one person spoke for the Crow when the decision was made to destroy the site to make way for the coal plant expansion. Hubert Tuleggins, the new Tribal Historic Preservation Officer for the Crow, says he laments that his predecessor, Dale Oldhorn, did not notify him or the rest of the Cultural Committee about the plan, which included backhoe excavation. Tuleggins says he visited the site for the first time this summer, when the excavation had come to a close. He says he believes the place is sacred and could have been a World Heritage Site.
There's just so much that we could have learned from this thing. But all that is lost now, and a lot of the people in this community are angry that it was destroyed. I think the bone bed was probably worth more than the coal underneath.
Dave Ferguson of GCM, the archaeology firm hired to do the excavation, says that the site is fabulously large, but not rare. He says his company hand-excavated enough to fill a semi-trailer, or approximately 12% of the site, before using the backhoe. He says he believes much of the rest is redundant, and that outcry over the potential ceremonial aspect of the bone bed, which holds the remains of nearly 2,200 bison herded into a cul-de-sac trap and killed over a period of perhaps 50 years, is overblown.
Hyperbole involving some of the mystic properties attributed to this site and the, you know, World Heritage Site, that's, in my opinion, gross and irresponsible exaggeration. I don't know of any culture that holds ceremonial religious activities in their garbage dump.
Meanwhile, Dale Oldhorn, the previous Tribal Historic Preservation Officer, is reportedly being investigated by the FBI for alleged double payments made by the tribe and Westmoreland during the excavation process, amounting to $500,000. We could not reach Oldhorn for comment. For National Native News, I'm Sarah Hosseini.
Historic preservationists and fans of Serpent Mound in southern Ohio are upset that New Age activists dug holes and planted strange objects in the ancient formation. WCPN's Brian Bull has more.
Initially, a group called Unite the Collective posted an online video in September showing members dancing across Serpent's Mound and talking about planting hundreds of so-called organites. The muffin-shaped objects are made of resin and metal shavings, and believers say they expel positive energy. Jane Mason of the Ohio Historical Society says while it was believed hundreds of organites were dug into the mound, the Adams County Sheriff's Department says so far there have only been about four found.
Unfortunately, at this point, the thinking is perhaps there is not enough vandalism to continue to pursue it, which is unfortunate. The mounds are very, very important sites in the state and to the country and to the world. So we really want to discourage any type of vandalism. We want people to enjoy the mounds, but we want them to enjoy them in a respectful way.
Native Americans formed Serpent Mound more than 1,000 years ago. It's been likened to the Great Pyramids of Egypt and England's Stonehenge. The video showing the vandals has been taken down, but Mason says some locals from the region may have a good idea who was involved. Anyone with information is encouraged to contact the Adams County Sheriff's Office. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
On this day in 1952, Charles George saved the lives of his fellow Army soldiers by jumping on a grenade during the Korean War. The Cherokee man was posthumously awarded the Medal of Honor. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation. Funding comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the McCune Charitable Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation. Kiwanis is accepting artwork for the 2013 Alaska Native Art Auction scheduled March 7, 2013. Proceeds benefit KNBA and Native Public Radio programming. Call 907-793-3528 for more information. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
It's 6 minutes after 3 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO News in Juneau, Alaska. Pat Moore here hosting your Juneau Afternoon program. And my first guest is from the University of Alaska's, she's the Alumni Relations Manager up there. Kenny Campbell is here. Hi, Kenny.
Hi, Pat.
So what do you want to talk about today?
Well, I thought I'd talk about year-end giving since it's getting close to the end of the calendar year here.
It certainly is.
Are you counting
down shopping days till Christmas?
Oh, I'm not very good at keeping on top of that. I'm usually scrambling last minute.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so tell us about year-end giving.
Well, of course, you know, December 31st is the last day of the year to make donations that will be tax deductible for the year. And we want you to think about UAS when you're making your year-end gift. And there's many different ways you can do that. You know, of course, we have lots of different funds you can give to, scholarships, program funds. You can always give an unrestricted gift, which is the best kind of gift for us to receive because that means that we can put it where it's needed most. There's also gifts in kind, which is something that you expressed some interest in today when we were talking before the show. And just recently this year, we received a fabulous in-kind gift. It's a Ziegler painting called The Ford. It's from an anonymous donor that's local, but it was given in memory of a family, Joe and Bessie Thomas. It was valued at $225,000, so it's a really nice original oil painting. It's a huge painting. It's about, I don't know, 5 by 7 feet. And it's currently hanging in the Egan Library in one of our conference rooms. And anybody can come in and see it. It's a locked room, but you can ask and say, hey, I heard about that cool Ziegler painting. I'd like to see it.
Mm-hmm.
And our librarians will be happy to open that up for you.
That raises an interesting idea, which is how would you have a number of things on the campus. There's a wall that was painted last year that's now part of your logo for some of your stuff that has the fish flying through the forest.
Ray Troll's
piece. And scattered all around the campus, there are little display cases and like that. Has anyone ever put together like a program of what you can find on the UAS campus?
There is a program for the artwork in the library, the Native artwork. There's one that you can go in, and I believe they have it at their front desk where they have a brochure of it. But it's a beautiful booklet that explains what the different artwork is. It was designed by our graphic artist, Allison Caputo. And it has beautiful photographs in it of all the things that are available to look at. The Ziegler painting's not in there. I think it's just the Native art that's cataloged there. But there's lots of artwork that's not cataloged, and that would probably be a good project for the near future here.
Well, it occurs to me that in one sense, the campus could be thought of as a sort of an open museum. It's
almost definitely.
Yeah, I mean, not the kind of, you know, a stuffy old-style museum or anything like that, but really a vibrant place where you can walk around it, if you're not a student there, and just take in a wonderful collection of objects and like that. You have a couple of totems.
We have two totems. And one was most recently raised as our eagle totem, and now we're in balance. Our moieties are in balance. So that's just a part of it, is the eagle totem and the raven totem. And then we're soon to be bringing out our whale sculpture that was created for us. It's right now it's by the Jack, which is, you know, right across the street over here.
Uh-huh.
The reason it's not out at the campus yet is because we've been doing a lot of construction. If you've been out there at all, you might have seen that. And when that comes out, we'll be announcing that and probably having a big party to invite everybody to come out and see that. And then, you know, anytime you want to come out and walk around campus, the public is always welcome.
It's not just for tourists.
No, it's not just for tourists. We do get a lot of tourists because we do have a great view of the glacier there and Elk Lake from the chapel that's there on our campus drive there. Mm-hmm. So we do get a lot of tourists, but I would encourage anyone in the community to come out and see what we have.
Kenny, I think people think that the university only wants money, and I guess my question is, what is the benefit to the university of having a $225,000 painting in the library?
Well, for one thing, hopefully it'll bring more people out, and it shows that people, you know, believe in the university enough to that people will come out and see the thing that they gave. It's an opportunity to showcase local artists, and if you have something, you know, I know that there's a lot of people in Juneau that have things tucked away, whether in their attics or in their homes, that you know, they may not know what to do with when they pass on. And you know, one thing to think about is the university. It's always something that we could use. When you do give to the university, though, a gift in kind is always has to be considered by the administration. And if they choose to accept it and display it, that's one thing. But another choice that they could make would be to sell it and use the funds to benefit some fund at the university.
And that would be by agreement with the donor.
Right. Yeah. We always work with our donor to meet their needs of what they expect from their donation.
What fraction, or is it possible to talk about what percentage of the university's operating or funds comes through donation?
Well, none of our operating funds come through private donations.
Right.
Our private donations finance things like scholarships. Student scholarships are private. It can help pay for the things that the state budget that we're given does not pay for. Things like program funds, those little extra things. The career education place often gets things like cars donated or equipment that they can use to in their process of their education and their programs, things like that. And, you know, special research projects that our faculty want to do or student projects, things like that. There's lots of different funds that benefit the different schools, School of Arts and Sciences, School of Education, School of Management. There's lots of different ways to benefit the students, whether through scholarships or classroom experience.
I guess I can envision a scenario where someone feels motivated to donate to the university and would probably need some assistance from someone to kind of direct the funds in a way that would both satisfy the donor and help the university in the most effective way. Is there someone who does that kind of thing?
Yes. Our office is called the Office of Development, which doesn't mean construction. That's a common misconception. What development means in our world is fundraising. And we're a small little shop. Our director is Lynn Johnson. And she would be the best person to contact. And if she's not there, they can contact me. In addition to being the alumni relations manager, I'm also the annual fund manager. So I help donors find out what they need to know. We do have a website off of the UAS page. So if you just go to the main page and then put /development, you can read all about our policies and the things that need funding and how that works, and maybe get a little bit of information even before you call, so you don't have to call to get the basic information.
I think the other thing that we were talking about before we went on the air is that while it's always wonderful if you receive a huge gift from someone, you're not really turning away someone who has a smaller gift to give.
Oh, no. Any gift is always welcome. We have donors who donate, you know, $5 at an event just because they felt moved to do so. And we have donors who have donated, you know, $1 million.
Mm-hmm.
So the size of the gift doesn't matter. You know, it's giving is about the giver.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's something that makes you feel good and what's appropriate for you and your family.
How long have you been doing this kind of work, Kenny?
6 years now.
6 years?
Yeah.
It's obvious you like it.
I do. I do. Yeah. I have a great office. I work right there with the chancellor, and it's just a fun place to work, and I get to interact with all the different departments and the other schools as well as Ketchikan and Sitka. So I've got a pretty varied job. It's fun.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you smile and laugh a lot, so obviously you're really liking your work.
Yeah.
Kenny, let's make sure everyone knows how they can reach you. If someone is interested in the donation program or some other aspect of what we've talked about, they would call whom or...
They can call the development office, either Kenny or Lynn, and okay. Our number is 796-6416.
Okay.
Or you can reach me by email, and it's probably the easiest way would be alumni or development, either one of those, at uas.alaska.edu.
Just that word, and then at uas.alaska.edu. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. And if someone is thinking of a gift to the university, this is the time to think seriously about it, because we have just less than a month to make the deal here. So
yeah, but if you want to give back to them, that's fine too. And don't forget about us for that PFD time, because we are part of the Pick, Click, Give program as well.
A wonderful and very easy way to yes. let your key charities have the money that you'd like them to have. Thank you so much for coming down and telling us all this.
Thank you, Pat.
Music is a live cut from a wonderful album called Goat Rodeo, featuring Yo-Yo Ma and a number of other classically trained instrumentalists cutting loose a little bit in the studio. There's a classical group that's going to cut loose this week in Juneau, and we have them here. The Juneau Bach Society is performing two of Bach's cantatas, a wonderful bit of timing for the season. Gentlemen, with me are Bruce Simonson and Philippe. Philippe, how do you say your last name? I should know.
De Merval.
Oh, okay. Thank you. So, the performance is what? Saturday, December 1st at 8 and Sunday, December 2nd at 3. So
that's correct. At Northern Light.
Yeah.
Yep. Well, thanks for having us. It's great to be here.
My great pleasure. I think you were just on KRNN a couple of minutes ago with
Larry
West.
Yep, Larry.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a great pair of concerts and cantatas. And one of the things I want to say up front is that we're really lucky to have some extraordinary vocal soloists as well as instrumentalists. But these cantatas are very demanding, as Philippe will assure you, and put the soloists through their paces. And we're lucky to have Kathleen Wayne, Mark Calvert as tenor, and then, of course, Philippe is singing the baritone bass part. So it's really great.
What makes a piece a cantata?
Well, in Bach's repertoire, at least, they're designed for church services. Cantata is an Italian word. I guess Philippe can tell me exactly what it is. But basically, the intent is music intended for church services, which would amplify, put to music the lessons from the scripture of the day, or somehow support what might be the sermon going on. So they really are intended as religious church music. There's a small number of secular cantatas, which are sort of more fun about the use of drinking coffee, for example. There's a coffee cantata. The bulk of his surviving output is about 200 cantatas intended for church services. And they involve orchestras, they involve soloists, choruses, instrumental soloists. It's really quite the deal. And I think, you know, if you think back, what else was going on in Leipzig in those days? You didn't run out to the mall. You didn't go watch a movie. You, the community supported music in a big way. And so that was Bach's job as the town musician in Kantor and the churches. And his job was to provide music. And I imagine people look forward to it. Someday, let's go to a cantata or go to the church service and hear Bach's music. Yeah.
Now, Philippe, he said the music is difficult.
Oh, yes.
What makes
it
difficult?
First of all, when you're talking about Bach, what else is new? It's difficult in a, I think, in a particularly Bach-esque way, in the sense that instead of simply juxtaposing two melodies or two voices to form just a simple harmony with a main line, a main melody, and then an accompanying voice. We definitely have a lot of counterpoint going on, but it's the kind of counterpoint that makes the occasional moment of harmony sound more like a happy coincidence maybe not happy coincidence, like an intended happy junction, if you will, than prosaic harmony might make it sound like. It sounds like there are 4, 5, 6 different melodic lines in Bach's mind at the time, and he picks whichever notes need to be put on the page in order to tell the story or in order to make his point. And that's very hard to follow when you're trying to read a piece. It makes for difficult intervals in particular. That's the biggest difficulty in the pieces that that the soloists get to sing, is the intervals.
The interval is the distance between two adjacent notes and the what you have
between
to do
two
with
notes
voice.
That follow one another, and the intervals between the two voices,
mm-hmm.
the harmonies are not prosaic. They're not your typical thirds or fifths. You know, they are ruled. One gets the impression that they are ruled by other considerations and other intents than just harmony.
Ah.
In fact, it seems like harmony itself, the logic and the theory of harmony itself doesn't play any real part in Bach's choices.
And interesting. Now I've got to listen to it again, because you articulated something wonderful about the way Bach uses the human voice. That's fascinating. This is two stories. These are the first is inspired by the Book of Revelation, and the second comes from the wonderful parable of the 10 virgins. So it's two points in the Advent year. The Revelation is normally read prior to the beginning of Advent, so that the end times are brought to mind in the church services.
Right.
And then starting with Advent, we begin looking at some of the key stories of the Bible and like that, and then recreate a great number of them on Christmas Eve in most services. Yeah,
you've got that exactly right. Cantata 140 is designed for the Sunday of the church year that comes right before Advent, so it's like the latest possible Sunday that you can get before you start again. But Cantata 19 is not a Christmas one. It's Michaelmas, which is in September. But it is the book of Revelation. It's about the end of time. So both of these things are about what happens at the end of the church year before we start over again,
right,
or at the end of time in the universe.
We have a snippet here that I'd love to play, which is out of 19, and it's the war, right?
It's the opening movement.
Good, okay. So here we go.
Thank you.
Es erhob sich ein Streit. The first little snippet there, about 3 minutes of the first of the 19th cantata by Johann Sebastian Bach, which will be heard Saturday and Sunday evening with me in the studio. The director who was could not hold his hand still during during that playing of the music, and of course Philippe. I'm going to do it again. I cannot get your last name.
Dom Nerval.
No, thank you, Dom Nerval. Anyway, as we were listening, you said something wonderful about the nature of Bach, Philippe. Can you say something about that again?
Well, I was just saying that the music of Bach, when Bach was writing music, he was doing it a little bit as, you know, the best mystery novelists might write a really, really good mystery, where you read the story. You are given clues, but you're not always aware that you're given clues. And then you start to get this feeling that there are, you know, so many parts, so many components to the story. And then all of a sudden, at the end, you think to yourself, that's it, I've got it. It was the sister-in-law. But instead, it was the butler. And now you think about everything you've read in the entire book, and you realize, of course it was the butler. I should have known this from the beginning. And so Bach's music is like that. Once you listen to it, if you just let yourself go when you listen, you realize that there are many individual components which were intended to fit together from way in advance, like a grandmaster playing chess. And it's when they finally come together, it's not an accident. It's not laborious, it's marvelously simple, and you get this exhilarating feeling that everything makes sense. Ah, I get it now, and everything is wonderfully coherent.
It must be wonderful to be telling the story, because you know how it's going to end, and your audience may not, in which case you have the kind of internal thrill of watching them get it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely, that's exactly it. Singing Bach is exactly like that.
So,
yeah, I agree with that. You know, for me, it's a real pleasure doing this kind of music in Juneau. I'm always amazed at the many, many things that are going on in this great town of ours. And it's been my pleasure to really be able to do these great works of Bach. The chorus is doing a great job. Our soloists are great, and our instrumentalists are wonderful. Lisa Ibeas and Teda Whitaker are performing violin and oboe obbligato parts that are just exquisite and beautiful, beautiful music. So for me, it's just a great pleasure. But the other side of it is, you know, of course, I love the rehearsal process, because we start and people roll their eyes and we can't possibly get this. And you're like, what are you thinking? You know, it's like, and you kind of have to agree with them, except I never do, because I know they can do it. And, you know, after about 3 weeks, it's like starting to become familiar, and then we get it down, and it's great. So I love that part of it. But the other part, it kind of speaks to what Philippe is talking about, is that it provides another opportunity for me to really study these works and find little gems, diamonds that are just sitting there waiting to be discovered. For example, these two cantatas, which are really separated by 3 months in the church year.
Mm-hmm. And they a have, long time in Bach's writing career.
Well, I'm not sure. Well, yeah, I think so. It could be. There are pieces of each done. But the main thing is that they both deal with sort of the end of time issues.
Mm-hmm.
And in the one that we just listened to, for folks who know music, don't be intimidated if you don't, because it's the way to think of this is like there's a place where they're singing. They're singing in key of B-flat, and instantly across, like right that quickly, they go to the key of E major, which is a tritone apart. And it's as outrageous of a thing you can do in music in Baroque as is possible.
Uh-huh.
It is just, and for Bach's audiences, they would have heard that and they would have probably, you know, slipped a disc or they really would have gone, holy cow, what's going on? And for us, where we've heard this kind of juxtaposition in our lives of different music genres or whatever, it's not so jarring. But for me, it's like a delight to find that. And it also happens in the other cantata. Philippe has a recitative where he goes from the key of B-flat, surprisingly enough, to F-flat major, which is E major, again, this tritone, and the word is on betrübtes Herz, which is troubled heart. It's like we're talking about Christ talking to the church, and they're going to come together and relax, still your betrübtes Herz. And it's like this transition from a B-flat to an E-major chord would instantly wake up everybody in that congregation. They would go, what? What? And to find these things in two disparate cantatas, or a transition from a, you know, a tritone apart in the tonality, literally on a beat, is like amazing. It's really, for me, I just love
it. The opportunity to do exactly that with this music is arriving very shortly. Tomorrow night at 8 p.m. is the first of these concerts, and then Sunday, December 2nd at 3 p.m., they're both at Northern Light United Church. The soloists are like a panoply of great singers from Juneau: Kathleen Wayne, Mark Calvert, Philippe Damarval, did I do it right? Lisa Ebias, Jetta Whitaker, Emily Weaver, Rick Cross, and of course Bruce Simonson conducting, and a wonderful concert for the Christmas for the beginning of the Christmas season. So
yes.
Thank you very much, gentlemen,
thank
for
you,
coming
Pat.
In.
Thank you,
thank
for
you
having
very
us.
Much indeed.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 30th of November, 2012. It's the birthday of the man who said, a successful book is not made of what is in it, but of what is left out of it. Mark Twain, born Samuel Clemens, Florida, Missouri, 1835. His first book was a collection of short stories called The Celebrated Jumping Frog of Calaveras County, came out in 1867. Did not sell many copies, but it made his reputation. And 2 years later, Mark Twain published The Innocents Abroad, his humorous book about traveling to Europe with other American tourists, which was a big bestseller. In fact, it was the best-selling of all Mark Twain's books during his own lifetime. Over the next 25 years, he published Tom Sawyer, Life on the Mississippi, and in 1884, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, founded his own publishing company, published the memoirs of Ulysses S. Grant, which was hugely successful. And then, as most people know, he invested a huge amount of money in the automatic typesetting machine called the Page Compositor, which turned out to be an abysmal failure. He was in financial trouble. His book, A Connecticut Yankee in King Arthur's Court, did not sell very well. He took his family to Europe, wrote Pudd'nhead Wilson, 1894. It did not sell well either, and so he went on a worldwide lecture tour to earn money. In 1896, his daughter Susie died at the age of 24 from spinal meningitis. And after that, Mark Twain sank into depression. His wife, Olivia, died in 1904. And a year later, on this day in 1905, Mark Twain turned 70, and he had a big party at Delmonico's restaurant in New York City. Willa Cather came, Andrew Carnegie. There was a 40-piece orchestra, and Mark Twain got up and gave a speech. He said his 70th birthday was far superior to his first. He said, I remember the first very well. Everything was so crude, unaesthetic, primeval. I hadn't any hair. I hadn't any teeth. I hadn't any clothes. The secret of long life, he said, was to smoke only when awake and to avoid exercise at all costs. Here's a poem for today by Linda Paston, entitled Vertical. Perhaps the purpose of leaves is to conceal the verticality of trees, which we notice in December as if for the first time, row after row of dark forms yearning upwards. And since we will be horizontal ourselves for so long, let us now honor the gods of the vertical, stalks of wheat which to the ant must seem as high as these trees do to us, silos and telephone poles, stalagmites and skyscrapers, but most of all, these winter oaks, these soft-fleshed poplars, this birch whose bark is like roughened skin, against which I lean my chilled head, not ready to lie down. A poem by Linda Paston, Vertical, from her collection Traveling Light, published by Norton and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Wall Street Journal Weekend Edition, offering articles from international writers about finances to art, food, wine, and culture. You can celebrate the weekend at subscribe.wsj.com/getweekend. And by the Poetry Foundation, iPad users can download the three most recent issues of Poetry Magazine, celebrating its centennial in 2012, at poetryfoundation.org. And by the Mosaic Foundation of Rita and Peter Hayden, based in Ann Arbor, honoring the literary arts and the universe of great ideas. Written by Betsy Allister, edited by Joy Biles, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
20 minutes before 4 o'clock, you're in tune with KTOO News. My next guest is Phoebe Rohrbacher, and she's here to tell us about the World AIDS Day Candlelight Vigil coming up tomorrow night at 6. Hi, Phoebe.
Hi.
So, what's up?
So I wanted to come here to let the public know about the World AIDS Day Candlelight Vigil. It's going to be tomorrow night, 6 o'clock at the Baranoff Hotel in the Franklin Street Gallery.
Okay. And what's going to happen?
We're going to have a vigil to in a remembrance of all those who have died of AIDS-related causes, and to also remember that the AIDS epidemic is still spreading. Globally, there are 34.2 million people living with HIV. There are 2.5 million new infections every year around the world. And this past year, there were 2.5 million new infections, 330,000 of whom were children. So it definitely is continuing to spread, despite the advances in technology, prevention, and testing.
Yeah, I think there's two sides of a wonderful story here. The United States and other countries have been doing a tremendous amount to help and to move the number of AIDS cases down toward the zero mark, but we're a long ways from that, and mm-hmm. it's still an epidemic. It's
yeah.
still a plague.
Yeah, it is.
So, as I understand it, Pastor Subaleta will be there to speak a few words. You're going to read 214 names of non-survivors.
Yeah, that'll be, we'll be doing a name reading of a number of people in Alaska who have died as a result of AIDS. Mm-hmm. We encourage people, anyone in the public to come, especially those who have known anyone who has HIV or people who do have HIV, people who've had loved ones who've died of HIV to come yeah. and remember.
Okay, 6 o'clock at the Baranoff in the Franklin Street Gallery for the World AIDS Day Candlelight Vigil tomorrow night. It's 16 minutes before 4 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO News. My next two guests are inventors of, I don't know, you call them inventors. They're two gentlemen who are putting together a new card game called Historical Conquest. Hi, guys. This is Zach Edwards and Lauren Bettridge. So tell me about this card game.
Well, the card game was based off of an idea that card games that youth have been playing for a long period of time, and it didn't seem like they were learning anything, they weren't doing anything, and actually a lot of parents were up against it. So we created a historical card game that's basically much like the ones of the past, Yu-Gi-Oh, Pokemon, Magic, but with a twist, they're all historical figures. Characters, events, places. So in this same time that you're playing a game that everyone that's played it enjoys, they're also being able to learn something. So, and that's the gist of it. It's basically a mix between Pokemon, Yu-Gi-Oh, and Risk.
When I raised my son, he turned out to be a massive gamer, and still is, as a matter of fact. And I kept thinking as I was watching him memorize the number of damage points for every Pokemon figure in the deck. With no problem at all, he could recite those without the slightest problem, but if you had asked him a question about the English assignment he had from school, it would have left him in tears. So it sounds like you're on a real quest here. I guess the real question that I have, having tried a couple of times to look at things like math programs that my kids could work with and like that, how's it work? Have you tried it out on audiences, and do people play the game and enjoy it?
Oh, they enjoy it, actually, of all ages. We have everyone from college students, where we actually designed it. It was started as an assignment in college, to seven-year-olds. It's about the seven-year-old level is where they first start it, because they have to comprehend what's being said and the abilities. And then you go up to, we actually have some grandparents that play with their grandkids, and actually by themselves, historian, people that like history.
Mm-hmm.
And so this way, I actually used to be a big gamer with Magic, and my parents didn't like that at all. And though I never had any problems with it, I soon moved on to other things, and then this game came up, and I play this with my wife.
So, you didn't bring a card along with you, did you?
I actually did.
Good. Can you give me an idea of what I would draw in, you know, if I were making a play?
Well, for example, we played last night, and I used...
Okay, this is Lauren, right?
We used I used Attila the Hun and the French army with George Washington to attack Mexico.
All right. Now, how much history do you have to know in order to be able to assemble that play?
You don't have to know any history,
okay.
But there is, on the cards, there is a section that talks about the history of each figure or country or event. And then there's a separate section that talks about their strength in attacking and defending and their special abilities. So you don't have to know, but it's a good way, it's a good segue. There were characters in the game that I hadn't heard of, historical figures, that I was able to learn more about.
Uh-huh. And in the course of play, how do I learn the historical lesson?
Actually, on there, as Lauren was saying, there's actually a summary of the person's life. And the abilities that each card has is based off of that history. So you have Attila the Hun, who is a great conqueror. He has a conqueror card. And he's able to attack people at a higher rate, larger strength, and also he has abilities based on that history.
Hmm.
Though I can't recall that exact history or that exact ability, each of the cards have that ability.
I think he was the one that before you attack, he's able to sneak in and kill a leader, you know,
right.
from the other.
Yeah.
So there's a chance to actually taste this game. You guys are arranging tournaments for people to play it. When's your next one?
Actually, tomorrow.
Tomorrow. And
tomorrow
where?
At 3:00 at the Utter Culture.
Okay.
They're allowing us to reserve that room that they have on the
And they got a side room in there that they were trying to figure out what to do with, I think, when they rented the space. Yeah,
cool. So we actually have a dozen young men that have already RSVP'd and some adults that have as well.
Mm-hmm.
And there'll be prizes. And
is there a charge for admission or anything?
No charge, okay. Except for a deck. It's the regular price, which actually you can get at Hearthside or at Imagination Station. And then when you come to the game, the tournament, if you don't have a card deck, you can actually get it for a certain price, the same price.
Oh, okay.
$10 for a starter pack, $4 for booster packs, which is completely comparable.
So it's the same structure as like Magic and that sort of thing, where
and
you have
actually,
a base deck and then you have to add cards.
Exactly,
yeah,
exactly. And the same price.
Decks, yeah.
And actually somewhat cheaper.
Is the sequence of play similar to Magic?
Pretty close. But it also has the process of Risk as well, where you have lands that you put your characters on.
Okay.
And you defend those lands. And there's actually two different goals that you can go for. You can go for morale. You want to bring peace and prosperity to your civilization, or you go for world domination. So you get to choose where you're going to bring the game.
This is exciting. You guys are going to get rich, and then I'll say, I knew them back when. Okay, so Zach and Lauren, you guys are organizing this tournament at Utter Culture. You're starting at 3 o'clock, did you say?
3 o'clock.
3 o'clock. Okay, and if people want to get in on it, what do they do? Do they call somebody?
Or,
you said RSVP, though. How are you?
Those are just people that have come in contact with us, seasoned players.
Said cool, okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Okay.
Also, for more information, there is a Facebook page. Or you can just Google search Historical Conquest.
Okay.
And for upcoming tournaments and whatnot, we'll list things on there.
Okay. Guys, this piece of music that I'm going to play was actually for the last guest, but I want to make sure it gets played because it has to do with the AIDS vigil that's going to be held starting Saturday night at 6 p.m. at World AIDS Day. So not appropriate to your game, but a piece of music that we really need to play for Phoebe Rohrabacher's Amen.
I got a friend with AIDS, he's just like me and you. I got a friend with AIDS, we got a lot of living to do. Some days we get sad, so here is what we do. We play together as much as we can, and I love him a lot, cause he's my friend. Yeah, me and my friend with AIDS, got a lot of living to do.
What is AIDS?
It's a virus bug.
What can you do?
Well, I give him a hug.
You hug your friend?
Sure, and he hugs me.
But aren't you scared?
Well, I used to be.
I'd be scared.
You'd learn a lot.
What would I learn?
What's safe, what's not?
Could I get AIDS?
Well, that's hard to do.
But some kids have it.
Yes, that's true.
Where's the AIDS?
It's in his blood.
What if he bleeds?
We patch him up. Cause AIDS won't let his blood cells fight.
So I shouldn't touch his blood?
You got that right. I got a friend with AIDS, and someday he might die. But someday so will you, someday so will I. Some days we get sad, so here is what we do. And my friend with AIDS, got a lot of living to do.
Well, my next guests on Juno Afternoon are here with props. So I know you can all see clearly in the studio that we have a wonderful 20-ounce bottle of the new brew, and my guests are from Alaskan Brewery, and they are introducing Imperial Red, which is the release of the season in the pilot series. Nancy Wojcicki and Darren Jensen are here. Hi, folks.
Hello. Hi. Thanks so much for having us.
I'm looking at this brew. So,
yes.
Hey, I read a description of this thing, and it's a complex bottle of beer, isn't it?
Pretty complex. Yeah, this one has, it kind of suits the needs of all beer fans because it has the malt. There's a bunch of crystal malts that we added in this, and it's fairly complex malt bill. And then we also hop it up quite a bit with a newer variety of hop called a Meridian, and it's only a two-year-old hop. So it has the malt and it has the hop, so it really kind of, it's kind of the showcase of both. And pretty dark and red, 8.5%. So
what makes a red beer?
The crystal malts that we use.
Okay.
Basically, it's kind of a combination. Always use like the base malt. And then it's a combination of crystal malts, maybe a little chocolate malt. And it helps give it that hue. It's not necessarily bright red, but it has a hue of red.
Uh-huh.
And it's fairly dark. So it really kind of comes out, and it's just a great beer.
Well,
be proud of.
Let's find out how great it is,
yes.
Shall we?
Okay.
Yeah.
We've
Sound
done this
effect.
Before. We got this right on
yeah.
the air
okay,
here. This is
here
the
we
bottle
go.
Being opened.
Beer.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of times people talk about a beer being, you know, especially hoppy or especially malty. And this is really, we've always kind of prided ourselves on a good balance with those types of beers anyway. But this really gives us an opportunity to showcase a style of beer that is intended to be big in both malt and hops. And so this is kind of right up our alley.
Yeah. I'm seeing this red color.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
So I wasn't lying.
No, you didn't.
No, it's got a red hue to it. So it's really, that's kind of the tricky part with nailing an Imperial Red. There is kind of an art behind that, and I think this one just kind of really comes across really well.
Well, I've done
color.
The two required sniffs,
so,
and
okay.
I'm getting balance, definitely,
because
usually that hop just, I'm not a big hop guy. So.
But it's got a beautiful, beautiful tan head.
Uh-huh.
The Meridian's kind of, they are becoming, some people call these kind of a mintier hop, so mint. We also use some other combination of Summit and Centennial hops. Summits kind of lend a kind of pretty unique hop aroma. It's got, in a good way, it's kind of an onion garlic, kind of a root based kind of hop aroma.
Very
so
earthy.
In combination
that's what I was
getting, of that.
Was just earth,
yeah.
Really earthy flavor. Mm-hmm. Too.
Yeah, so it's the hop aroma is really unique. And then, of course, with the malt really kind of balances that out. And so for old ESB fans, I just got to say that this could actually be a really good second choice because though we're not brewing ESB anymore, this beer is the malt hop combination like our ESB was. So this might tie some people over for a little while.
Yeah, I don't think my wife's going to like it because she's an IPA, major IPA fan.
But oh, really?
You've got a big IPA coming out real shortly here, don't you?
Yeah, we have one out right now. Hopothermia.
Oh, yeah? Oh,
yeah.
Is that...
yeah. We have that on tap out at the gift shop if anybody is interested in that
might have
as
to
well.
Go by and take a run at that.
That's actually around town, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's
yep.
a few places
yep.
that have hopothermia.
This is going to be in 20-ounce bottles and
22-ounce
tap,
bottles.
Right?
It'll be on tap out at the brewery starting tomorrow, and you'll start to find it around town in restaurants and retail outlets probably sometime next week.
Which gives rise to the fact that you have some kind of locator on your website, so
yeah.
that if I want to know where I can find an Alaskan beer, you've actually got it up there?
We do, but unfortunately it's the only place where it doesn't work is in the local Juneau area because we do our own distribution. But the good news is that virtually any liquor store that you go into, you'll be able to find our beer.
Well,
so it's pretty easy.
You're all over the West Coast now, right?
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
Moving east,
we're in 13 states in addition to Alaska. So
uh-huh.
we've actually crossed over the Mississippi into Wisconsin, so we're kind of making our way.
Don't you know?
Yeah, sure. Nothing goes with hot-ish like an amber.
Oh, sure, you betcha.
So, yeah, this beer, like Darren said, is it has that big malt and hop profile, and it's going to be one thing you can't see as well here on the label is actually a king crab, and it's the first time that we've featured seafood on our label, and so it really makes sense. It's an imperial red, so it's a big red king crab.
Well, I have
as well.
To say, I love the balance of this beer. It's just it's there. I mean, you have a hop, you have malt, you have them both, but they're very nicely balanced. Against each other.
There's almost a little bit of, I think we call it like a Meyer lemon character too, that gives it a little bit of astringency, just enough to kind of make your mouth water a little bit, but not overly drying.
Oh, I'm liking this one. I might have to. Invest in another.
It'd be worth it.
Yep.
Yeah, it's a good one. It's one it'll hold up for a little while, but this one's definitely fresher is best.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
Well, that fits my plan even better.
I just wanted to mention, too, that if you're interested in trying this, not only is it at the brewery, but we're going to be serving it next week, next Friday, as Gallery Walk. And so the Alaskan Brewing Depot downtown will be serving this. We'll have some friends from the Juneau Symphony stopping by and playing some Christmas music and lots of specials at the depot. So come on by and try it then.
Outstanding. Alaskan Brewery, thank you so much
for
keeping my day the joy that it is on the
we're
radio.
We're glad to
thank
do it.
You.
Thank you.
You're in tune with KTOO in Juneau. We are broadcast throughout the area on a set of translators that take our signal into places where our main signal doesn't get too easily. In the Valley and Off Bay, we're on K276 AF. That's at 103.1. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, it's K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus hears us on K201 AM at 88.1. K220 BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, KTOO is on K210 AS at 89.9, and in Juneau, you can also hear us on GCI Cable Juneau or on digital channel 871. Tomorrow, you can listen to Katie Bowsler, Monday, actually. You know, Katie Bowsler will be hosting. She's got Sally Smith coming up about the Holiday Pops concert. Sharon Lobaugh will be here to discuss her opening this Friday at Art Matters and the Saints and Sinners concert. Christine Armour from Discovery Southeast will also come in to highlight the First Friday event and the upcoming Backcountry Film Festival. Pat Moore, been your host for the last hour. Thank you very much for tuning in. Thanks for listening to Juneau Afternoon.